You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to an author who tells the story of three couples and their quest to live, work, and eat more simply and sustainably.
First, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released new federal guidelines for the human papillomavirus, or HPV, vaccine. The new guidelines say all children should complete the vaccine series between the ages of 9 and 13. The CDC said about 39,000 new HPV-associated cancers are diagnosed in the U.S. every year. The vaccine can prevent most of the cervical, throat, anal, and genital cancers the virus causes, but vaccination rates remain low.
Last week, the UW-Carbone Cancer Center endorsed the new recommendations. Dr. Howard Bailey joins us now to talk about this. He's director of the UW-Carbone Cancer Center. Dr. Bailey, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
It seems like partly this is a recommendation change, partly an effort to boost vaccination rates. First of all, what has changed in these new guidelines?
So the main change to the guidelines is that they're supporting or recommending that when younger individuals get it, that they can get just two doses of the vaccine rather than the prior recommended three doses of the vaccine. So the main change is that, and they're just stressing a bit more. And this, and I'll explain here just quickly, the reason they're stressing the younger age is that the data and the experience shows that the immune response in a vaccine is based on creating your body's own immune response to this delivered vaccine. The immune responses are much stronger the younger a person is, so they really want to stress that. And what we've tried to stress as well, this vaccine is about preventing cancers. That's its goal. That's the main purpose behind it. And that's what we want to try and continue to extol to the public, that this is about trying to prevent cancers.
Right. So if they get it in this age 9 to 13 range, they can get away with two doses. Older kids and adults, if they get it, they would still need, if I understand this correctly, the three-dose treatment.
You are correct, Rob, that the recommendations are that especially for those 15 and over, that they still get the three-dose regimen rather than just the two doses. And the two-dose recommendation is you get a dose, and then 6 months later, you get the second dose.
Let's talk about this virus, the human papillomavirus, or HPV. From what I'm reading, a lot of people in the United States have this. A lot of people are carrying this.
That's correct. I mean, so in the, you know, the globe as a whole, there are a 500,000 to 1 million cases of HPV-caused cancers each year. And in the United States, that runs into, you know, many tens of thousands and more that happen. And to give an example for our kind of public and our community, clearly all cases of cervical cancer that women get are related and caused by this virus. What's important to note is that one of the highest increasing cancers in the United States is oral cancers, especially in young men who don't happen to smoke or drink, and that's almost always caused by HPV, this virus infection. So there is data that now says that in the next 5 to 10 years, there will be many more men or young men in our country getting oral cancer from this virus than women getting cervical cancer from it.
And this virus, it's not something like influenza where if I have it, I know I'm going to have it, it's going to make me sick right now. I'm going to have it, I'm going to carry it, maybe I'm going to spread it, and it may give me, it's going to boost my risk of these different types of cancer down the road.
That is correct, Rob. And that, so what happens with this virus, and it's very common that many people, and there are literally hundreds of types of this human papillomavirus, but then there are about 20 to 30 versions of it, if you will, that have the potential to cause cancer. And just for the audience to hear, how this virus causes cancer is that the virus gets into the cells, whether it's lining my mouth or lining a woman's cervix, and it gets in those cells, and then it basically gets involved in the DNA of the cell, and it makes the cell go bad, for lack of a better way of putting it. So the HPV virus literally causes these cancers, which is why we make such a big deal out of trying to prevent these infections, because if we prevent the infections, we will then prevent the cancers.
Talking to Dr. Howard Bailey from the UW Carbone Cancer Center about the HPV virus and the vaccine, some new guidelines out from the CDC. Let's get into the vaccine. It sounds like it is pretty effective. What are the rates of vaccination, though, in this country? How many of us are getting this?
So, again, if we look at boys and girls from 11 to 13 or 11 to 15, basically, the vaccination rate varies from region to region, but it varies anywhere from lows in the 10 to 15% range to highs in some regions in the 40 to 50%. There are very small areas where they've gotten it above that, and there's many reasons why, and, you know, certainly time and expense and other things, or concerns or fears, whether valid or invalid, related to the potential side effects or toxicities of the vaccine. So globally and in the United States, the vaccine rates aren't nearly as high as we would hope them to be, because what we know is, while even if it's low, it'll prevent some of the cancers for the individuals who get it. What we also know from experience with hepatitis vaccines and other virus-associated cancers, if you can get the vaccine rate up to 70 to 80%, you have a very high chance that you can almost totally wipe away that cancer. And so that's why we're pushing it and really recommending, and we want to make sure that people have the adequate information, the guardians, the parents, to make those decisions and for their children, their loved ones. But as a cancer physician, what I can pass on to them is, there are far too many men and women dying of these cancers, and when we know there's a way to prevent that, we obviously get behind it.
As I understand it, HPV, the virus itself, can be, one of the ways it can be spread is through sexual transmission. And I remember early in the days of the HPV vaccine, anyway, that led some parents to be suspicious of it, the link between that and sexual transmission. Is this part of the issue of lower vaccination rates?
Well, it might be. I mean, other issues are cost, convenience, concerns about side effects, any number of things that people are concerned about vaccines, whether it's for rubella or, you know, any number of things. So that is part of it. The research that's been done that we've written on this as well, we've never been able to show that sexual activity goes up because of the vaccine. But clearly, you know, people are going to have their opinions or beliefs in that. But what is, you know, again, what we strongly hold is that here is a way to prevent men and women from dying of these cancers. So, you know, that's why we are continuing to advocate for it.
And as far as we wrap up, as far as effectiveness and safety, does this vaccine generally work to prevent the spread of HPV? And is it safe when it comes to side effects?
Yeah, well, So the data says, in these literally many, many thousands to tens of thousands of men and women and boys and girls who have gotten it, so that if you get the vaccine before you start having any degree of sexual activity, it is nearly 100% effective at blocking that further infection and thus blocking the risk of cancer. From a safety standpoint, in the large studies where they've compared people getting it versus not getting the vaccine, there's pain at the injection site. You can get fevers from it. Beyond that, there has not been any difference between those who got what we call placebo or not getting the vaccine versus those who did. But there are reports out there, and especially in Europe and in Japan and others, of wondering about syndromes that might happen, a pain syndrome or arthritis. I've talked to people from other countries about this, and they've been reviewed both here and in other countries, and we have not been able to show that was directly caused by or associated with the vaccine. But I acknowledge to people this is an important decision, and they want to make sure they have all the facts on it. But certainly my belief is that this is a safe vaccine and that the benefits far outweigh the risk.
We have to leave it there. Thanks to Dr. Howard Bailey with the UW Carbone Cancer Center.
Stay with us here on Central Time. as the world grows more and more complex and fast-paced, dropping out to find a simpler way of living may seem all the more appealing. At the same time, it can seem like it's harder than ever to simplify our lives. And yet, some people do take the radical step to opt out of mainstream culture and create a more simple life.
Our next guest tells the story of three couples who took that step and managed to find simpler ways to live, eat, and work.
Mark Sundin joins us now. He's a contributing editor at Outside Magazine and the author of The Unsettlers, In Search of the Good Life in Today's America. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, why did you go looking for examples of people who are living lives against the grain, people that you call unsettlers?
Well, I just found that in my own life, I spent a lot of time doing things I didn't really like, which was to say, filling out paperwork or doing jobs I didn't like just for the money. And then I also felt that the things I did just to stay alive, which is to say, feed myself and put gas in my tank and finance my house. I seem to be supporting industries that were making the world a worse place. And I said, how can I break out of this cycle? And can I find people who've actually done this, who've led a life of resistance that didn't make them crazy or didn't make them completely broke?
And you call these people unsettlers. How would you define that?
Well, the phrase comes from the Wendell Berry book, The Unsettling of America, about how industrial food systems are sort of depopulating our farmland and destroying our soil. I use the term a lot more broadly, and I define it as people who have taken these steps to not drop out of society, but to rebuild systems of food, fuel, and finance that are sustainable and that give our lives more meaning.
This has a lot in common with the back to the land idea that goes back to the 60s and or earlier. Is there anything different about the idea today and that back to the land ethic?
Well, I think that the back to the land movement was largely about dropping out. And in those days, if you got off the electrical grid, you could make the case that you were making a dissent against a system that destroys us. These days, because of technology and because of the internet, you can live off the grid in absolute luxury, and you can trade stocks on Wall Street from the comfort of your little mountain palace. I actually wrote in my book that the off-grid commuter is just a suburbanite with a longer driveway. So these people, I think what makes them different and what makes this movement different is they're much more engaged in solving problems, sort of the worst problems that we face, which is to say racism and war and climate change. And the second thing that's different is that one of my families lives in Detroit, which totally surprised me when I discovered that during my research. I expected all of these people to be out in the boondocks in rural America, but instead some of the most innovative, dedicated, and radical people were in our cities and trying to revive them.
Right. You track in your book three different couples who are living various versions of unsettling. Can you introduce us to them?
Sure. The first family, Ethan and Sarah, they have founded a community, an intentional community in northeastern Missouri. And in some ways, they're the most radical in that they live without electricity, without cars. They don't travel in cars at all. They don't use airplanes. They don't have cell phones. I mean, they don't even have light bulbs. They basically are living very similar to the Amish, and also they're dedicated to sort of nonviolent direct action and social change. The second family is Greg and Olivia, who are in Detroit. Olivia is African-American. She was born in Detroit, and she has this sort of miraculous story where she got a great education and a scholarship to college, coming from a pretty disadvantaged beginning. And she didn't want to leave Detroit, and so she and her husband ended up starting a farm on a city block of vacant lots, and they're making a living selling vegetables. And the third family, Steve and Lucy, and they're in near Missoula, Montana. And I included them because they've been doing this for 35 years now. And in that time, it's really not compromised their ideals. They run an organic farm. But even without compromising, they've managed to succeed by almost every measure in America, which is to say they own a lot of beautiful land, they have a nice house, they've raised three children who have not been deprived of any of the opportunities that America has. And I thought that was fascinating, that they could be so committed to this alternative life and also achieve the American dream as we know it.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the first year or two was like for some of these couples? Because this isn't something that's, you know, by nature, it's not necessarily easy to pull off something like this. There can be poverty, there can be hardship, there can be personal risk involved. So what was it like for them?
Well, Steve and Lucy, beginning in the early 80s, they bought in as partners of this organic farm, and they lived in a teepee for about 5 or 7 years, and they were earning a salary of about $2,000 per year. And so, this is Montana, so it gets cold in a teepee, but, you know, they pulled all their water from the creek. They rode bicycles to the farm each morning, and they heated with the wood stove. They would bathe in a by heating water on that stove. But I think the most important analysis of that is that they didn't feel like they were suffering. They absolutely thought they loved this. They thought it was so fun to live this way, and they didn't want to live in a big house and have electricity and have hot running water. Like, they thought this was fun. And I think that goes for all of the families. They've endured what we see as hardship, but they haven't done so by wearing a hair shirt or feeling like martyrs. They've actually pursued what they love to do, and it just happens to be far outside of the mainstream.
We're talking with Mark Sundin right now. He's a contributing editor at Outside Magazine, and we're talking about his new book. It's called The Unsettlers, In Search of the Good Life in Today's America. And Mark, one thing about these couples is that, you know, they're not people who just want to drop out of society, live off the grid. You write that they're also trying to tackle some of the world's problems, to find solutions. Can you talk about what they're doing to get that done?
Sure. I mean, to begin with, Greg and Olivia in Detroit, you can't talk about Detroit without talking about racism and race. And, you know, I mean, Detroit came to be an African-American city because of the Great Migration from black people leaving Jim Crow and coming up north. And then, of course, that was followed by the white flight, all the white people moving to the suburbs. And then this urban decay, which is why there's a bunch of vacant lots that can now be farmed on. So they're not just growing food. They're trying to revitalize the neighborhood. They're trying to, by example, empower the black community. You know, they're entrepreneurs. They own a business, and they give a lot back to the community. So it's much deeper than just we're growing a couple vegetables. Greg, who's Olivia's husband, he was a public school teacher for 20 years. And he said when he was young, he thought the way to change the world was through public education. Now he thinks it's through the local food movement.
You know, listening to these stories, I mean, it's appealing to me, and I know it's appealing to you, too. That's part of why you were drawn to this. But it can't, by definition, be something, it seems like, that everybody can pull off. Not everybody can make this happen with their finances or their life circumstances. But are there pieces of what you learned here about what these three couples have done that the rest of us can follow and make our own, if not going for the whole enchilada?
I hope so. I find these people incredibly inspiring, and the fact that they've had the courage and the imagination and the willpower to follow their dream, to follow their heart, makes me think I could do things in my own life. You know, another thing I'd add to that, though, is of course not everyone can live like this, but often I think we say that as a means of sort of excusing ourselves from changing our own behavior, because on a larger scale, like, not everyone can live like me. If everyone lived like me in the world, we would need 4 planet Earth to give me enough food and gas and, you know, other materials. So the way that Americans live is unsustainable. The way these people are living may not be replicable, but that doesn't mean we should. shouldn't or we can't imagine something more similar to what they do.
So can you think of one or two things that we could do that would be getting us a little ways toward that?
There's all sorts of small things, from taking money. If you don't like Wall Street, if you don't like banks, take your money out of the bank, put it in your local credit union, or refinance your house with a local credit union. You can really think, where does your fuel come from? Can you bike or walk or take public transportation instead of supporting these oil companies that are denying climate change and hastening it? But ultimately, like, this book isn't a prescriptive. It's not about, here are some things you can do to save the earth. This is a book, I hope, that will encourage people to look into their heart and follow it. And I guess I have this optimism that if we look into our heart, we're going to find a better vision.
And, Mark, as we wrap up, what did this dive into unsettling mean for you in your own life?
Yeah, what I found in these couples was they had this courage to pursue the thing that they loved. And when they did that, they sort of found that abundance appeared around them. It wasn't like they cut out a bunch of the things that they loved and suffered and then felt self-righteous. It's they pursued what they loved. And for me, you know, I don't necessarily love farming and homesteading as much as these people, but I was able to commit to things that I did love, which was my writing and activism. I built Strawbill House after I finished this book. I spent some time up in Standing Rock reporting on that and being a part of that movement. So I guess it was just to find ways to do work that I loved that also gave my life meaning.
Mark, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was writer Mark Sundin. He's a contributing editor at Outside Magazine and the author of The Unsettlers, In Search of the Good Life in Today's America.
Coming up, we'll talk about how climate change is being discussed on Capitol Hill during the Senate confirmation hearings. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up tonight after 7, it's True Stories Told Live on the Moth Radio Hour. This week, an hour devoted to misfits. An awkward teenager finds his place at a museum. A child is given a sense of structure and order in life. And a daughter does her best to soothe her elderly mom. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, Senate confirmation hearings are currently underway for several of President-elect Trump's picks for his cabinet. Among those being vetted, candidates who will work in agencies tied to the environment are being asked about climate change. Their answers have taken some by surprise.
Do you agree that global warming is a hoax?
I do not, Senator.
So Donald Trump is wrong?
I do not believe that climate change is a hoax.
Man has had an influence. I think that's undisputable as well. So climate is changing. Man is an influence.
I believe the climate is changing. I believe some of it is naturally occurring, but some of it is caused by man-made activity. The question is how we address it in a thoughtful way.
You just heard Scott Pruitt, Ryan Zinke, and Rick Perry testifying in front of senators. These three nominees could represent the EPA, the Interior, and the Department of Energy, respectively. Their answers seem to have parted ways, at least somewhat, with President-elect Trump's stance on climate change.
Rob Meyer joins us now. He's an associate editor at The Atlantic, where he covers climate change and technology. Rob, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Well, a new administration coming in tomorrow, and President-elect Donald Trump has said in the past, in tweets, that he believes climate change is a hoax orchestrated by China. And in December, he was asked by Chris Wallace of Fox News Sunday about his stance, and here's what he had to say.
Where are you
on
the environment?
I'm still open-minded. Nobody really knows. Look, I'm somebody that gets it. And nobody really knows. It's not something that's so hard and fast.
Now, Rob, you cover climate change for The Atlantic. What is the consensus about climate change from the scientific community?
Yeah, man, it's not something that's hard and fast. It's not like a property of the Earth's, you know, atmospheric chemistry or anything. The consensus in the scientific community among, you know, at least 97%, perhaps even more, of working climate scientists and really earth scientists and you know, scientific researchers who spent time on the issue, is that, you know, not only is the Earth's climate changing, not only is it changing in ways that we can observe within our lifetimes, but that human industrial activity, that greenhouse gas emissions, are the driving influence, are the thing that's changing the climate. Associated also with human changes in land use, also done by humans. Contra what Trump says, at this point, there's about 20 years of history in the scientific literature that is very clear that people are the ones doing the climate change. And not only that, but we've been able to predict it fairly well, too.
And we just heard, before we started talking, clips from the hearings this week. We heard from Texas Governor Rick Perry, who's up for the Department of Energy. We heard from Mr. Pruitt, who is a nominee to head the EPA, and also from Ryan Zinke for the Interior. Did anything surprise you in their answers?
I mean, the first thing that I thought was interesting is they were clearly all pre-briefed about kind of what the Trump administration line on climate change is going forward. They all said basically, as we all just heard, the same thing. The climate's changing and humanity is an influence, but how much of an influence is humanity, they're not going
to
say.
Right. That seemed to be the main distinction they were drawing. No one said climate change was a hoax, but it seemed as though everyone said, but we don't know how much humans are influencing it. That seems to be the line.
Exactly. And we do know, to be clear, you know, science is very clear that we are the ones doing the influence. I think the second thing is that this is the Republican Party's line on climate change as a whole, especially at the national level, has varied a lot. Sometimes over the past 8 years, it's been much more kind of blanket denial. It said, this isn't happening. Climate scientists are lying to you. Before that, the Bush administration sounded more like the Trump administration does now, where they said, oh, you know, sure, it's happening, but how bad will it get? Do we know that humans are the ones actually causing it? Scientists aren't sure about all of those things. I would say the main goal of all of this has been that to see doubt about what the scientific evidence shows on climate change. You know, it's not to get people to think that climate change isn't happening. All they want people to think are that climate change isn't clear, is that we don't know everything yet, and to kind of put off action further into the future.
And during his hearing, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders was talking with Scott Pruitt, getting his take on climate change. And we have a little bit of that exchange between Sanders and Pruitt. Let's take a listen.
You are applying for a job as administrator for the EPA to protect our environment. Overwhelming majority of scientists say we have got to act boldly. And you're telling me that there needs to be more debate on this issue, and that we should not be acting boldly.
No, Senator, as I've indicated, the climate is changing, and human activity.
But you haven't told me why you think the climate is changing.
Well, Senator, the job of the administrator is to carry out the statutes as passed by this body and to
comply with. Why is the climate changing?
Senator, in response to the CO2 issue, the EPA administrator is constrained by statutes.
I'm asking your personal opinion.
My personal opinion is immaterial.
To the job of you are going to be the head of the agency to protect the environment, and your personal feelings about whether climate change is caused by human activity and carbon emissions is immaterial?
And that was an exchange between Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders questioning EPA nominee Scott Pruitt. And he's been a controversial nominee for Democrats and for others. He has sued the EPA several times over the years. What did you take away from that exchange? He's saying his personal opinion doesn't matter in this case.
Yeah, I mean, this was a tack tried by Sanders and by a lot of Democratic senators to get, I think, the depths of Pruitt's nonchalance or apathy about the issue to kind of come forward. And Sanders was the one most successful. I think what I took away from the exchange is something that, you know, you could gather from the rest of Pruitt's record, which is kind of on federalism grounds and on these, you know, extremely narrow textualist readings of what federal environmental laws say. He thinks he wants to shave away the a lot of EPA regulation and sees his job as kind of the lawyer in chief, the person who will come in and restore things to what should be their rightful austerity. While Sanders is saying, you're not just in charge of any old federal, you know, division, you're in charge of the Environmental Protection Agency, and you should care about the project of environmental protection as opposed to just being somewhere else in the government. I think the one thing that was interesting is from the whole hearing is Pruitt kept talking about how, because of this Supreme Court case from 2007, the EPA has a legal obligation to regulate carbon dioxide under the Clean Air Act. And it absolutely does, both as a legal fact and I think as an ethical fact. But he never got pressed by Democratic senators as to what that obligation would be, how he would interpret that obligation, and how he would go forward with that obligation. And so he was clear that he was interested in regulating this issue. He never described how he would do it.
Rob Meyer is with us right now. He's an associate editor at The Atlantic, where he covers climate change and energy.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think the federal government should do to address climate change? What do you expect Donald Trump's administration to do based on what you've seen from the president-elect and his cabinet nominees so far? Should the government do anything at all to address climate change? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're continuing our conversation about how climate change is being discussed during the Senate confirmation hearings. We're talking right now with Rob Meyer. He's an associate editor at The Atlantic, where he covers climate change and technology.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How big a role should climate change reduction play in the upcoming administration? What do you think of the new administration's approach to climate change and what you've heard from the president-elect and his cabinet nominees so far? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And based on what you've heard so far at these hearings, Rob, do you expect that any of these nominees would be a contrarian to Donald Trump, what he said so far? I mean, if Donald Trump stands by what he has said, that's unclear at the moment, but would you expect them to be at odds and maybe pursue, you know, differing policies?
I think that is probably unlikely. You know, I think it depends less kind of what Donald Trump says he believes in radio interviews and TV interviews and more what he does. I think actually one of the unifying parts of the Republican Party platform right now is an opposition to doing much about climate change at all. That unites the party far more than you know, economic issues or medical healthcare issues do, and it goes hand in hand with increasing fossil fuel extraction, which has been a goal both of kind of the George W. Bush era of the party and the incoming Donald Trump era of the party. So I think it's unlikely. I think the most interesting kind of cabinet post for me is Rick Perry at Energy. In Texas, as governor, Perry was really good at supporting renewable energy, you know, wind and solar, and specifically wind. And there's a small part of the Department of Energy budget that's nonetheless really important for the kind of American renewable energy world of renewable R&D funding and loan guarantees and stuff like that. And I expect that it would be very possible that Governor Perry, kind of seeing the role that renewable energy has played in his own state and how economically important it is to lots of states in the country, not just those on the coast or, you know, those that typically vote for the other party, would continue kind of those corporate R&D funding efforts and loan guarantees. And that's something that I'll be very interested to watch as the administration takes over.
Let's take a caller now. We have Willem joining us first in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. Well, on the issue of climate change, I think over 150 national science organizations around the world have concluded that it is man-made and that we are contributing as CO2 emissions that, you know, are causing the climate's changed. Plus, there's not only is there scientific evidence, there's empirical evidence. I mean, we can just see it all around. And I think seeing how it's the job of the government to protect its citizens, I think it's important that we address this issue. And I'm left to wonder, why are the Republicans? I mean, the only conclusion I can come to is it's financial support from the oil and gas industry. There doesn't seem to be any other logical reason for them to deny it. And I think it's as far as being pro-life, I think it's a pro-life issue because, you know, the life of the planet, all of God's creation is at risk.
William, thank you so much for the call. And Rob, what do you think? Is it the job of the government to protect the planet and preserve it if with climate change?
Well, I mean, I definitely agree with the caller that the job of the government is, mutual defense of the citizens, and there are plenty of risks posed by climate change that constitute kind of could constitute economic or some kind of attacks on us or decrease our property value somehow. I would be clear too that it's really only the National Party and parts of the local party among Republicans that try to seed doubts about climate change and that oppose climate action. There's lots of coastal Republican, municipal officials. There's a lot of House representatives from Miami who say, listen, I can definitely tell you from my own experience that the seas are rising. There's something about the climate that's changing, and we should do everything we can to stop it because it's causing real problems for my constituents.
But it sounds like every Republican is going to be voting for Pruitt based on what we know right now, including one Democratic senator from West Virginia. So what do you make about that if there's this concern among other constituents?
Well, I think I think the Republican Party is, first of all, quite ideologically opposed to environmental regulations across the board for economic reasons. And the ways that action against climate change has taken in the past 5 years has been primarily regulatory because there's nothing Democrats and climate advocates in general haven't been able to get a bill through Congress. I think the second thing is that there was a concerted effort in the 90s to seed doubt about the roots of climate change in general. It was led by many of the same scientists who actually told people that smoking was safe for many decades after most medical scientists knew that it wasn't. And it seeded a lot of doubts about whether climate change was real, whether the science behind it was legitimate. And I think that effort was very effective in kind of turning climate change into this partisan issue, into this thing where your opinion about it means something about your identity rather than your opinion about it just being, an assessment you've made about the world. There is something odd happening with the American National Republican Party and climate change because when we look across the country, or rather across the world, there's no other conservative, center-right party in the world that has that says climate change isn't happening or that has as many doubts about it as so many senior Republicans do. A friend from the UK just sent me this book. In the UK, the royals are supposed to be apolitical. They can't engage on any partisan issue. And climate change is so non-political in Britain that Prince Charles just wrote a book trying to educate adults about it. And so it's really only in America that we have this divide about it. And I think it's because of our high partisanship that exists.
And we leave it there. Rob, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
That was Rob Meyer, an associate editor at The Atlantic, where he covers climate change and technology. And he joined us to talk about how climate change is being discussed in the Senate confirmation hearings.
Consumers, insurance companies, and healthcare providers are experiencing a bit of deja vu. Politicians are once again attempting to make a big change in the American healthcare system, and this time Republicans are in the driver's seat.
But there's disagreement within the party about how fast they should go about dismantling Obamacare and where they'll end up. Shemaine Mills reports on the impact of health care changes and the impact they could have on jobs and careers.
Most Americans get health insurance where they work. Some are stuck in jobs they hate but can't leave because they'd lose benefits. There's a name for that, job lock. A 2008 Harvard Business School study estimated it affects 11 million people. 30-year-old Sadie Tischer was able to free herself from so-called job lock because of the Affordable Care Act. In 2015, 2 years after the marketplace was up and running, she bought health coverage for herself and started a business.
I have always wanted to work for myself and be an entrepreneur.
Tischer formerly worked as a disability benefits specialist for Milwaukee County and also as an elder benefits specialist for a nonprofit law firm. Now she's an independent insurance agent with her own office in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin Health Insurance Advocate.
I love the independence of it. I love making my own hours. Deciding the direction of my business is amazing.
Before the ACA, getting insurance could be difficult. When Tischer was laid off from her job at Legal Action of Wisconsin in her mid-20s, she tried to get individual coverage and was told she had a pre-existing condition.
My pre-existing conditions were small things. I'd hurt my ankle in a hiking incident and had to have physical therapy for it. The issue was resolved, but it was still considered a pre-existing condition.
She also had been on an antidepressant after a family member died. Because of these two pre-existing conditions, she was denied insurance she sought and offered a less comprehensive plan. Even though this was before the ACA, some insurers still allowed parents to put children on their plan until age 26. And that's what Tischer did. It's a popular provision of the ACA. President-elect Trump has said he supports it. But if young people can be on their parents' insurance, they're not purchasing their own coverage. State Representative Joe Sanfilippo says this is an example of how the ACA is unsustainable and not well thought out. The chair of the Assembly's Health Committee says it's a great benefit, but it undermines the insurance market.
Well, you want those young, healthy people buying insurance and paying premiums. So now you're shooting yourself in the foot when you allow them to be on somebody else's plan until they're 26.
So Republicans have a dilemma. Scrap all of Obamacare or save some of it. Keeping older children on parents' insurance is popular but costs money. The House has laid the groundwork to repeal Obamacare, but there's no consensus on a replacement or when it might take effect. That makes some who rely on the marketplace, like Tischer, nervous.
I always tell clients it's kind of a game that we play. We're betting on our own future health. And the Affordable Care Act sets mandated limits for an individual's out-of-pocket spending. Before the Affordable Care Act, it was the opposite.
In other words, patients were on the hook for bills until they went bankrupt. Before the ACA, insurers could stop paying after a certain amount, usually $1 million over a lifetime of benefits. Patients without insurance are a problem for health care providers, too. Mike Wallace is CEO of Fort Healthcare. During a panel discussion in Madison, he says he's seen a lot of changes in the industry, and he's preparing for more by channeling his inner Aaron Rodgers from the Green Bay Packers.
I tell people to relax. You know, seriously, a little perspective on this on the front lines.
Wallace says if Obamacare is repealed, people will still need care. And he says it's their job to ensure they get it. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow, Donald Trump will be sworn in as the 45th president of the United States. We'll check in as the day unfolds.
We'll get our weekly look at the top state news headlines in our Wisconsin News Roundup. Rob Menser from USA Today Network Wisconsin will be back with us for a look at some of the top stories in state politics and more.
And it's winter, which means it is the ideal season to get baking, have yummy smells coming out of the oven. And tomorrow we get advice for better baking using wholesome ingredients. Get some inspiration for some weekend baking.
Yeah, I may actually look for that inspiration and try to do something this weekend. I haven't baked enough this winter, I'll say that. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Tomorrow after 6, tell Joy where to go for great ethnic restaurants around Wisconsin. Joy's guest has some recommendations, and you can share your favorites, too. That's tomorrow morning after 6 here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then Milwaukee's Common Council announced that it's going to take on problem landlords who rent out substandard housing while evading taxes and fines. We'll talk to a city alderman about the plan. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back.